The wish to live without enemies is very different from not having them. Avoiding enmity is not morality, certainly not in a Cossack culture that expects a man to stand up for his property and his rights. Appeasement, or getting out of harm's way, is far from bravery.
Welcome to Season 2 of The Stories Jews Tell, a weekly podcast with Professor Ruth Weiss, brought to you by the Tikva Fund. Today, we'll be reading Argamach by Isaac Babel. This season of the podcast is sponsored by Robert L. Friedman.
Well, I've been asked, and it's certainly a fair question, how I go about choosing the works for these podcasts. And the answer is embarrassingly simple. Generally, I try to select works that are both excellent in themselves as literary creations and important for what they say and how they say it. Well, Isaac Babel is one of Russia's greatest writers. In our first series of podcasts, we read his marvelous story of My Dovecot. And today's story, Argamach, I include also because of its importance to me, and I hope to you. Translated here by Peter Constantine, it probably needs more than the usual amount of background information in order fully to understand what's going on, but I hope you'll agree that it is worth reading, knowing, and taking to heart. So soon after the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917, the newly formed Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, the USSR, was drawn into a war with Poland, the Polish-Soviet War of 1919-1921, that resumed an old rivalry over national boundaries. The newly formed Red Army, which was led by Leon Trotsky, conscripted Ukrainian Cossacks into its ranks and allowed them to fight in their customary manner, that is, as horsemen and under their own leaders. And this was to be Europe's last cavalry war. Simultaneously, the Soviet leadership, then represented mainly by Vladimir Lenin as head of the government and Trotsky as commissar of military affairs, was consolidating its political control over Russia, and for that purpose, making abundant use of armed force. Within the army ranks, they also embedded so-called war correspondents as internal propagandists. Now, since Jews were the best educated sector of the Russian public, many of them were recruited to perform as, quote, unquote, information officers. In 1920, the Bolshevik Party in Odessa issued credentials as a war correspondent to Isaac Babel. Under an assumed name, Kirill Vasilievich Lyutov, he was assigned to the cavalry army on the Polish front under the command of General Semyon Budyonny. Babel spent that summer on the front lines, and in the aftermath compiled a series of stories, the Red Cavalry stories, based on the diary that he had maintained on the front. The first series, published in 1926, made him famous and very controversial. By 1932, when our particular story appeared in the second revised edition of Red Cavalry, Joseph Stalin, Lenin's successor, had imposed strict censorship on writers, demanding that they promote Soviet aims. Until then, Babel's reputation had given him greater literary access and freedom than was ever enjoyed by any Russian Jewish writer. But he also understood the risks of continuing to write independently. The risks that he took as a writer would prove much more dangerous than those he describes having taken in battle. As fiction, Red Cavalry expects us to identify Lyutov, that is, Babel, as the autobiographical narrator, thereby reinforcing the story's impression of realism and fidelity to the facts. Our story about the horse named Argamach, which was added to the 1932 edition, opens after a long summer of clashes, seesawing back and forth between the Soviet and Polish forces. Everyone on the Soviet side is expected to pull together, but the cultural differences between Jews and Cossacks remain profound. Evidently, Lutov was still feeling some need to prove himself to the others. So he begins as follows. I decided to join the ranks at the front. The division commander grimaced when he heard this. Why the hell do you want to go there? If you let your mouth hang open for a second, they'll shoot you point blank. I held my ground, and that wasn't all. My choice fell on the most active division, the 6th. I was assigned to the 4th Squadron of the 23rd Cavalry Regiment. Babel's prose is famously compressed, and nowhere more so than in conveying wartime conditions. As an information officer, Lutov is expected to teach the party line to the Cossacks in the regiment and to report on the war's progress. In earlier stories, we see him writing letters for the soldiers and reading them Lenin's speeches in Pravda. But now, for whatever unspecified reason, and clearly to prove his mettle, he has requested a position in the front lines and defies the division commander's scorn in order to achieve it. The rest of the story tests the wisdom of this action. So the squadron commander to whom he is assigned is Baulin, a factory metal worker and, quote, a mere boy. He had grown a beard to inspire respect. Ash-blonde tufts covered his chin. In his 22 years, Baulin had let nothing ruffle him. This quality found in thousands of Baulins proved an important element in the victory of the revolution. Baulin was hard, taciturn, and headstrong. The path of his life had been decided. He had no doubts about the rightness of his path. Deprivation came easy to him. He could sleep sitting up. He slept pressing one arm against the other, and when he awoke, his path from oblivion to full alertness was seamless. Now to this, Lutov adds, quote, one could expect no mercy under Baulin's command, unquote. The juxtaposition of his glowing portrait of the new Soviet man with the ominous warning that one could expect no mercy from him makes us wonder why this volunteer soldier would be needing mercy from a commander under whom he has elected to serve. But Lutov's real war is being fought not against Poland, but within the new Soviet system. Any other Soviet apparatchik might have been satisfied to stay on the sidelines in his safer job as an information officer. Lutov, however, wants to be accepted by his fellow soldiers. He has volunteered for the front to prove himself to both the Cossacks and the Soviet authorities, and perhaps also out of his ambition as a writer to be at the center of events. And there's something else. Without the term Jew ever being uttered in the story, his being a Jew is the most obvious thing about him. Lutov's initiative seems to start out well when he is assigned a horse, an unusual favor since horses were by then in very short supply, and his previous assignment to transport carts placed him very low in this military hierarchy. Sure enough, the gift turns out to be poisoned. The horse had belonged to the Cossack Pashka Tichomolov, who had captured two Polish officers, and instead of taking them in for questioning, as required, he had executed them. For this, he was to be tried by the Revolutionary Tribunal, a council set up to mete out punishment for infraction of military regulations, and incidentally, to enforce the new Soviet authority. But the Cossacks had their own equally strict standards of justice, and their squadron commander, Baulin, decides on a Cossack punishment harsher than the tribunal could have inflicted. He takes away Pashka's stallion, Argamak, and demotes the horseless Pashka to the transport carts. Adding further punishment to both Pashka and Lutov, Baulin also assigns this precious animal to a man who doesn't know how to ride. This is leveling society with a vengeance. Incredible how much compressed social history is being telegraphed in this dramatic situation. Bowlin knows better than the Communist Party how to bring all parties to heel. Depriving Pashka Tikhomolov of what is most meaningful to him, he strikes at the heart of his Cossack values. I'd say this is like ripping a Torah scroll away from a traditional Jew. As for Lyutov, he is shown just how pathetically far he is from being a Cossack and what damage he has inadvertently caused by going where he isn't wanted. Lyutov moans, "I didn't have a chance to get used to Argamak's cruel, bounding trot. I shook like a sack on the stallion's long, dry spine. I rode his back to pieces. Sores appeared on it. His miserable horsemanship destroys the horse. He is not fit for the task." Bowlin has done something at once sadistic and effective, creating an equivalence between these two products of radically opposite cultures. Egalitarianism requires homogeneity, which the regime accomplishes by taking from each what is most precious to them. In opposite ways, as Bowlin makes sure to demonstrate, they are equally unfit for communism. "You've liquidated that horse, Four Eyes," my platoon commander said. Lyutov had described himself earlier as someone with spectacles on his nose and autumn in his heart, and Four Eyes is not a term of praise. The Cossack's anger with this intellectual for ruining the fine animal is nothing compared with the personal hatred directed at Lyutov by its owner, Pashka, who makes sure that his buddies in the squadron keep letting Lyutov know how furious he is. If all Lyutov wanted was to be accepted on the same fraternal level as the others, they instead no longer even ask him to write their letters home. He finds comfort only in nightly dreams, where he rides Argamak at full trot, and the Cossacks, as he passes their campfires, don't even turn around to look at him, their indifference assuring him that he rides like everyone else. In those dreams, he gallops off and is happy. Meanwhile, there's a brutal war going on, and Pashka, who is still out there fighting, performs heroically in the battle for the city of Rovno. Pashka lined up his carts in a battle formation known only to him. It was doubtless how the Romans lined up their chariots. Pashka had a machine gun. With this machine gun, he repelled the attack, saved his possessions, and led the whole transport to safety, except for two carts whose horses had been shot. Although this achievement wins him no amnesty, it is understood that he has reinstated himself, and he duly returns to reclaim his horse. In describing this scene, Babel spares us no more than these men spare themselves. He writes, "Pashka's toes had been hacked off. Ribbons of black gauze hung from them. The ribbons dragged behind him like a train." Bowlin is sitting on the steps of the town church, his own rotting toes in a steaming bucket, as Bizyukov, one of Pashka's buddies in the company, puts a lighted cigarette in his mouth. The horse gives its master a rasping neigh of recognition, but it, too, is horribly injured, with, quote, "pus coiling like lace between the strips of torn flesh on its back." Lyutov steps forward, eager to make peace. "I am glad the horse is going back to you, Pashka. I can't handle him. Let's make peace." "It's not Easter yet for people to make peace," says the platoon commander, who had called him Four Eyes. And Pashka's friend, Bizyukov, is even crueler. "Kiss him three times, Pashka," he says, referring to the symbol of the Holy Trinity. Their sarcasm conveys the contempt that Pashka expresses most openly. "I will not make peace with you," he says, and walks off with Argamak trailing behind him like a dog. Lyutov, is left isolated among the men whose friendship he had failed to win. "Why did you saddle me with an enemy?" he says to Bowlen. "None of this is my fault." To which the squadron commander raises his head and issues the most devastating judgment on the Jews that I had ever read. "I can see right through you," he said, "right through you. All you want is to live without enemies. You'll do anything not to have enemies." Realizing that he has to leave, Lutov is transferred to another squadron, where things go better for him. Argamak had taught him some horsemanship. "My dream had become a reality," he muses. "The Cossack's eyes stopped following me and my horse." One could almost call it a happy ending if we can share Lutov's dream of having satisfied the Cossacks. A little paltry, though, isn't it? Lutov's satisfaction seems to prove that Bowlen is right about him. Bowlen challenges this Jew as he had never heard himself challenged before. Who wants an enemy? Especially the Jews who in that very same war were being massacred by both Poles and Cossacks. As a politically dependent minority whose country had been under foreign domination for two millennia, Jews had to hope for peaceful coexistence among the nations. Naturally, they want to live without enemies. But Bowlen makes a different point. The wish to live without enemies is very different from not having them. Avoiding enmity is not morality, certainly not in a Cossack culture that expects a man to stand up for his property and his rights. Appeasement, or getting out of harm's way, is far from bravery. Jews traditionally considered their way of life more moral than that of the Cossacks, who ever since the Khmelnytsky pogroms of the mid-17th century had been portrayed as brutish and murderous, illiterate and uncultured. The Bolshevik Revolution transvalued all of that by openly calling for violence, and in this war, by conscripting none other than Cossacks to represent the new Russia. As part of this new morality, Lutov not only works for the Soviet cause, but wants to win the respect of the Cossacks by proving himself on their terms. He tries to do this by going into battle, but they know he is not like them, and they don't respect him for what they see as toadying. Bowlen perceives that his wish for acceptance issues from a moral failure, the failure to stand up for himself. The insight that Babel ascribes to Bowlen is one he obviously took very seriously enough to level it here at himself. Still, it's hard to tease out any simple, single meaning from Babel, and this story is no exception. Ernest Hemingway, known for the dryness of his prose, said in praise of Babel's even more compressed sentences that, quote, "even when you've got all the water out of them, you can still clot the curds a little more," unquote. And yet, almost biblical in how much it leaves out, Babel's writing is in other ways incongruously lush. Pus, coiling like lace between the strips of torn flesh on the horse. Really? Like lace? Babel's rotting toes are pink, the way steel is pink before it is forged. I think that no other account of a war, and this is a book about a war being fought, was ever composed with such delicacy and refinement. The writerly elegance contrasts with the brutality of the subject in just the way that Isaac Babel, or his character Lutov, differs from the situation into which he has been thrust, and to which he must conform. As for Bowlen and Pashka and the Cossacks, they are only as admirable as Lutov makes them. It's not the voice of either the Cossacks or the Soviets, but the wonderfully civilizing voice of Babel that governs this work and everything within it. And then, too, Babel demonstrates the independence of these men that no totalitarian government can standardize and that not even the exigencies of war can discipline. Our author begins his story by telling us what he decided. And it's not just Lutov who wants to chart his own path. Tikhomolov fights and wins his battle in his own crazy way. Balin undercuts the authority of the tribunal, meting out private justice. Argamak defeats the rider who cannot win him over. The story is named for a horse badly damaged by the wars that are being fought within the larger war. But the animal never submits and is restored to his badly wounded owner. This story is very far removed from the kind of propaganda that our embedded Red Army information officer was expected to produce. You might think, as some critics have suggested, that Red Cavalry focuses on the incongruity of a Jew in a Cossack regiment. Babel, who was adjusting to the new Soviet reality, registers something quite different, and to him, far more interesting. He sees how Jews and Cossacks, however opposite, are equally resistant to totalitarian rule. In some of these stories, he highlights the similarities between these two cultural adversaries, whereas here, it is the nature and acuteness of their adversity that demonstrates why enforced homogenization is not likely to work. Nothing in this story supports, and almost everything subverts, the Soviet agenda. The ending carries a special irony. If in our story, Lutov is punished and called out for trying to force himself into the front line of battle, the regime that never stopped following Isaac Babel with its eyes had him arrested in May of 1939 and executed 8 months later. He may already have known that, in trying to prove himself a good servant of the Soviet regime, he had attempted something doomed to failure. Babel left that line, "I see right through you. You'll do anything not to have enemies," to reverberate in Jewish history. He robbed the Jewish will to innocence of its innocence. That is where we'll leave it for this week. And next week, we will be looking at Kadya Molodovsky's poem, one of the poems in a series called Women's Poems or Women's Songs. And for now, happy reading.